My name is Tim Smith, and I'm going to be talking today about practical wilderness survival. I'm a registered master Maine guide and have been teaching survival and bushcraft and guiding trips full-time since 1999. I started the Jack Mountain Bushcraft School in 1999, and since then I've been able to make thousands, maybe millions of mistakes. Thankfully, none of them have been fatal. But I think that we learn by making a lot of mistakes and learning from them. And if that's the case, then I'm well on my way to learning quite a bit. The point of this presentation is on keeping your body alive in an emergency or a crisis. So how does that happen? How do we keep our physiological self working and happy and all of the cylinders firing? And we're going to get there by talking about three different topics. Topic one is what you need to know, topic two is what you need to do, and topic three is what you need to carry. Section one is what you need to know, and it's important to remember that knowledge is power, especially when you're up against it. So while our world today might be unimaginable to our Stone Age ancestors, thankfully our bodies haven't changed much, so what worked for them is going to work for us. Let's talk about a survival situation. The term is thrown around quite a bit, but never really defined. So for me, a survival situation is an episode or an event that's going to kill you if you don't take immediate corrective action. Oftentimes, we confuse a survival situation with camping or with a mishap, but you know, the important thing is here is that if you don't take corrective action, that you're not going to make it through. So we've come up with something that we call the survival equation, and it's survival in a nutshell. So the survival equation states that if you can maintain your body temperature and get enough sleep to remain rational and drink enough water to allow cellular processes to continue to take place, then you're going to survive for a minimum of 40 days. And I say a minimum because it depends on how long you can go without food. And the average lean, healthy adult can go a minimum of 40 days without food, and that's supported in a lot of the literature. So with regards to that, we know that if we get too cold, that we're going to get hypothermia. And we know if we get too hot, we're going to get hyperthermia. We also know that if we get too dehydrated, that we're going to circle the drain, if you will, and then expire. So sleep is an interesting thing that isn't dealt with much in the literature. And I want to make clear that I'm not talking about missing one night's worth of sleep. I'm talking about the cumulative effects of sleep deprivation, because they inhibit your ability to think rationally and also greatly increase the amount of stress on your brain or your mind. So with that in mind, you know, someone who hasn't slept in several days is going to have a very difficult time thinking through anything rationally. And also the manual dexterity that we have, that we enjoy, is going to be greatly curtailed. So we know that if we can maintain our body temperature, sleep, and hydrate, then we're going to make it through the average survival episode. The average survival episode lasts less than a weekend, and it's usually a result of gear failure or somebody getting lost. But you know, the ironic thing is that many people die in less than 48 hours because obviously they're not taking into account and working on achieving those things, body temperature, sleep, and hydration, that are going to allow them to make it through the situation unscathed. So we're going to define what basic, intermediate, and advanced survival are now, and we're going to start with basic survival. And that's the knowledge needed to last 1 week in the forest or without infrastructure somewhere, without getting any help from anyone else. It's certainly appropriate for the weekend recreator to know, and I'm going to introduce a term called a knowledge unit, just to give you a relative idea of how much more advanced things become as you progress down the line. So basic survival, we'll say, consists of one unit of knowledge. And it's important to keep in mind that basic survival is not living off the land. You know, we have this thing in our culture. A friend of mine likes to refer to as TBH, or trained by Hollywood, that people believe too much of what they see on TV and in the movies and in novels and such. With that in mind, we can all think of a movie. If anybody's ever seen the film Jeremiah Johnson, where he's hypothermic, it's wintertime, he's starving, and so what does he do? He jumps off his horse and jumps into a frozen stream surrounded by snow, and catches a little trout with his hands. Now, as far as the story goes, the trout saves the day. You know, that gives him his food, and he manages to live another day. But, you know, the reality of the situation is that if he ate that trout, eyes, skin, you know, fins and everything, maybe he's going to get a couple hundred calories out of it. But he probably lost a couple of thousand calories by soaking his clothing, you know, by exposing himself to the cold water. So the reality of the situation with regards to survival is often very different from what people have in their minds, because the experiences they have, at least that they've seen or come in contact with, are usually Hollywood experiences, which just flat out aren't true. So the role of the survivor in a basic survival situation, he has three jobs. Job number one is to create a microclimate for his body, and that could be by using clothing or a combination of clothing, tent, shelter, fire, sleeping bag, pad, make your own bed, insulative layer of leaves or grass. There's you know, lots of different ways that you can go about achieving that. Job number two is to find and drink enough water so that your body continues to work. And the way that we usually do that is to try to drink until your pee is clear at least once a day, or you're passing at least a quart of water every 24 hours. And the third job is to make yourself comfortable enough to sleep. We look to get 8 hours out of 24 hours of sleep. 8 hours out of a 24-hour day of sleep. And those don't all have to be at night. They don't all have to be together. But you need to realize that sleep is a tool for you, and that in order and to get some sleep, you're helping your mind deal with a stressful situation. So sleep should definitely be emphasized. So once again, create a microclimate, drink water, sleep. It's certainly not rocket science. Intermediate survival would be lasting from 8 to 40 days, or however long a person can go without food. And if basic survival consists of one knowledge unit, intermediate survival consists of 10 knowledge units. So because it's a longer stay, it'll be more of a challenge. In bitter cold conditions, the physics of shelter and clothing and rime ice, you know, and keeping your insulative layers dry, all these things are going to come into play. It's important to know that if you can't meet your minimum daily caloric requirements by gathering, fishing, hunting, trapping, then you're going to last longer if you're going to last longer by fasting than if you're consistently running a calorie deficit. So some of the skills that are involved with intermediate survival are enclosed shelter construction, traveling, and harvesting firewood and other resources with a minimum of tools. And there's certain things that come into play with that. For example, you know, if you don't have an axe, if you don't have a big saw, if you're forced to use only the wood that you can gather by hand off the forest floor, then you're going to be forced to have larger fires, because smaller fires with that wet, poor firewood, that's just going to smolder, and you're not going to generate enough heat to evaporate the moisture in it to get it to fully combust. So, you know, the worse your toolkit is, probably the bigger fires you need to have to compensate. Advanced survival would be from 41 to 99 days, so preferably a season or two. And it involves harvesting and rationing food, making do with minimal reliance upon tools, but not replicating an entire material culture. And the assumption is still that you're going to be rescued eventually. So if basic survival is one knowledge unit and intermediate survival is 10, advanced survival is 100 knowledge units. And the reason for that is because you need to know how to find and harvest food. So in order to to make a go of it for several months in the bush like this, you need to know how to get more calories from the food that you're gathering than you expend in getting it. And that's a trick that's not well covered in the literature and definitely not in the survival school curricula that I've come across. These food gathering techniques can include actively harvesting, such as fishing with a rod or and a fishing line, or passively fishing with a net, a gill net, or a set line, actively hunting with a firearm or a bow, or trapping with modern traps and snares, or improvised or traditional traps, deadfalls, and twitch-up snares, gathering plants, mollusks, and whatever else you can get some calories from. But in addition to gathering the food, we're also going to need to know at least a little bit about processing and storing some food. There was that scene in the film and in the book Into the Wild about the young man who went to Alaska and ended up perishing in the bush. And he had the good fortune to shoot a moose, but because it was the heat of summer and he didn't know or wasn't able to dry or save any of the meat, you know, within 2 days it was filled with fly larvae and it was covered in maggots. So, you know, knowing what to do with the animal once it's down is a big deal. You know, I have friends, a lot of friends who guide moose hunting trips, and they always say that, you know, moose hunting, the real work begins once the animal's down. You know, it's fun to go out and stalk a moose and call him and hear him call back and, you know, get set up for the shot. But once that animal's down, then the real work begins because it's a lot of work to take care of all that meat without it going to waste. So intermediate survival, 100 knowledge units. So then beyond survival, if you're living somewhere for more than 99 days or you're wintering over, then you're not surviving. You're just living there. So I have some friends in northern Quebec, some native Cree guys who talk about how they used to travel to their hunting grounds from the summer rendezvous. And they would go with very little food, you know, just a little bit of flour, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of tea, and maybe some tobacco, which doesn't count as food, but they would bring that anyway. And they would rely solely off of what they could hunt, fish, and trap off the land. And, you know, you can ask them, what would you do if you weren't able to get some meat that day? And he'd say, then we were hungry. So there's a great story in a book called Caribou Hunter, where the gentleman, he was an Innu native from the Quebec Labrador Plateau and spent his life hunting caribou. And he says that sometimes people just starved. And it certainly wasn't because they didn't have skills, but it was just because that's the nature of living off the country in the north. That sometimes, some days you'll see 1,000 caribou and some months you won't see any. And it's important to note that once we get beyond food, that, you know, when you're living off the country, you're also responsible for reproducing the entire material culture that you need. Things such as clothing, you know, canoes or other boats, tools, sleds, snowshoes, you know, all these things you have to be able to make yourself from what you have on hand. With regards to fasting versus living off the land, there are a few points that are worth touching on. Number one, if you're going to try to live off the land, you need to meet your minimum daily caloric requirements. So if you're pretty sedentary, figure you need to get at least a net 1,500 calories into your body. And that could be up to as much as 3,000 to 5,000 if you're actively, say, hauling a sled in the wintertime on snowshoes and working physically very hard. And also, you know, you need to add a lot more calories. If you're constantly cold all the time, your body's going to be running pretty hot to compensate. Or if you're sleeping cold, then you're going to be burning a lot of extra calories there. It's important to know that you need to get more from the food that you're harvesting than you expended in gathering that piece of food. Man, there's a great quote in one of Sam Thayer's Edible Wild Plant books where he talks about how in short-term survival, food is of little importance. In long-term survival, however, food is the most important aspect. So I think that's reflected in, you know, up to 40 days or so, if you're going to be out for that long, say if you're lost for a month, then food really isn't of any importance at all, because you know that you could fast and come home and, you know, resume your normal life with no lasting ill effects from the fact that you didn't eat for a period of time. But once you get far beyond that, you know, if you're in addition to or in excess of 40 days, then food is going to become a huge critical issue. The good news is that our bodies know how to deal with a lack of food, that over our evolutionary history, there have been periods of feast and famine. So once we go into that fasting state, once we abstain from eating for, say, 24 hours, that the ratio of fuel that our body uses changes. The ratio of proteins to fats to carbohydrates changes, because our bodies know we're entering a starvation phase, and we need to adjust for that. So the problem comes when we don't send a clear message to our body to indicate this process. And that would happen, say, if you are stuck out in the middle of nowhere and you're not able to come up with your minimum caloric requirements, but maybe there's a few blueberries around. So each day you're eating a few handfuls of blueberries and maybe a piece of jerky or something. So you're maybe getting 100 or so calories, you know, maybe 200 calories out of the deal, but it's nowhere close to what your body needs. So because you're not getting the caloric requirements that you need, but you're also continuing to eat, your body is being sent a mixed message, and it doesn't know to enter that fasting state. So in order to maximize your survival time, you need to send your body a clear message and not eat any food, not take in any calories, so that your body can switch gears like that. My personal experience fasting is I've done 8 7-day water fasts and 1 11-day water fast, and numerous shorter ones for a day or two. And I've also spent some time up north with the Cree, living off the country, you know, where you eat nothing but bush meats, beaver, moose, caribou, fish, goose, all these different things. So it's definitely a neat experience living off the country and living off the fat of the land. So if you ever have the opportunity to try doing it, highly, highly recommended. The last point I want to touch on with regards to what you need to know is the psychology of survival, and the idea that training the mind is of equal or greater importance than training the body. So your mind is kind of like a file cabinet or maybe a computer database, in that it reflects your belief system and what you've put into that database or file cabinet. So, you know, if you think about fishing all day, maybe you'll have dreams about fishing at night, and maybe the next time that you go fishing, you'll have rehearsed all these things in your mind, and maybe you'll have more success when you're fishing. The idea with survival is that you don't want to be your own worst enemy. Many people are their own worst critic. I think we can all associate with that. But when the chips are down, you need to feed your mind positive thoughts and have a positive information diet, meaning, you know, don't dwell on the negatives. Think about the positives and see about working them into your daily routine. As you train for survival and build on your survival skills, you want to try to avoid any sort of self-sabotage. Excuse me. And by this, I mean, as you're training your physical skills, you need to be also building your confidence. In practice, a good thing to do is focus on things that you do right. You know, oftentimes we will sort of skate through a planned exercise and not really notice the things that we do right, and then get all worked up about the things that we do wrong. So instead of that, flip that around and notice the things that you do right and self-congratulate yourself. Say, hey, I did that really well, or, you know, I really got that fire going quickly, or this is a class A shelter. Because this is going to feed that good, that subconscious of yours with good positive thoughts. So something to keep in mind is, if you think you're bad at something, you'll probably definitely be bad at it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you think you're great at something, you might be. You might not be, but, you know, the odds of you achieving some sort of success with that positive outlook on it are going to be much greater than if you're negative about it and think that you have no skill or no aptitude with it. There's lots of information on this subject in books on sports psychology. And a great one that I read this past year was called With Winning in Mind. And essentially, it's training your subconscious to work for you, not against you. We're moving on now to section two, or what you need to do. And to start this section, I want to talk for just briefly about your reptile brain. That all of us have this reptile brain. It's the brain stem, and it's the oldest part of the brain, about 100 million years old. And it's responsible for basic life support and takes over in a crisis. So the thought center of our brain, where we rationally think and solve problems, the neocortex, shuts down when we're in a huge crisis situation. It's much younger from an evolutionary standpoint. So what this means is that rationally solving problems in difficult to impossible situations just isn't a reality. And what comes forth is that fight or flight response. So anybody who's ever been lost in the woods knows that, you know, once you start to feel that you're lost, you have this irrepressible urge to run, and it doesn't make any rational sense. So that's important to keep in mind, because if you're ever faced with a crisis situation and you haven't planned ahead as to what you're going to do, your idea is just that you'll sit down and rationally solve the problem then. I can tell you that it's not going to happen. You know, that's just not an option. Once that reptile brain takes over, you know, you're going to have a difficult time thinking at all. So the way that we take care of this is by having a plan that we've rehearsed and that we've memorized beforehand as to what we're going to do when faced with a crisis. So that plan is called a survival plan, and it establishes the priorities of what to do based on what's going to kill you the fastest. So a plan like this is probably your most valuable piece of kit. It doesn't weigh anything. You don't have to burn any extra energy to drag it along with you. And it's going to focus on solutions, not problems. But probably the biggest reason is that having a plan that you've rehearsed plays very nice with your reptile brain. So that there's no thinking, there's no deciding, and there's no problem solving. That there's just doing. And an example of this would be, you know, if you think about a fighter pilot in the military. You know, they have to learn how to they practice and learn how to fly the plane so well that in a time of crisis, they don't need to focus on flying the plane. They can focus on the crisis. Similarly to, say, a hockey player. You know, when kids are learning how to skate, it takes all of their attention and energy to focus on skating and keeping themselves on top of their skates and not laying on the ice. But as they progress, they get to the point where someone who's been playing for a number of years doesn't think about skating. It just happens. And that's what we need to practice the survival plan enough so that you do it without thinking. Because as we've learned about our reptile brain, if you're in that situation, you're going to have to do it without thinking because you'll be unable to think. So our first priority with regards to a survival plan is first aid. If serious medical attention is necessary, we should attend to it first. And this is all about rapid trauma assessment and stabilizing major injuries. If someone has a penknife cut on their finger, you know, that's not something we're worried about. If you're still alive 30 minutes after an accident, there's about a 95% probability that you can survive for at least 3 more days without further medical attention. So what we're talking about here are things like, you know, a sucking chest wound or an angulated fracture of the tib fib, you know, or the radius ulna, things like that. We're not talking about minor things. We're talking about something that you're going to be dead long before you need to worry about making it through the night. So our first priority is to stabilize any major injuries. Our second priority is having a fire. So in my mind, fire lighting is the most important cold weather survival skill that you can learn. And in ideal conditions, it's super easy. But when it's wet, when everything's frozen or covered with a quarter inch of ice, then it's much, much more difficult. If you can't build a fire, then we need to maintain our heat source, which is our body. So we need to really protect that by staying out of the wind, by staying dry, and insulating it. And for my money, in an emergency, the very first thing I do after I make sure that no one has any super debilitating injuries is to get a fire going right away. It can warm you, it can dry your clothing, be your shelter, purify your water, be your signal, and keep the bugs at bay. And in addition, it provides an enormous psychological lift. So an example of this, about 7 years ago, I was guiding a canoe trip on the St. John River in early May in northern Maine. And, you know, there was still some ice in the water and there was definitely still snow on the banks of the river. And we came around a bend the first morning. We were about 8 miles from the put-in, and it's about a 110-mile, 108-mile trip with no support along the way. So we came around a bend, and one person flipped their canoe, and everybody went for a swim, and the water was, you know, just a few degrees above freezing, and it was probably in the 50s that day. And so the first thing we did was fish everybody out of the water, and the second thing we did was get a roaring blaze going right on the shore of the river. And, you know, the blaze was hot enough that you couldn't stand right next to one. I'm not talking about a tiny little campfire. I'm talking about something that was big and hot. And that was big and hot within about 4 minutes of that person dumping the boat. We had that fire roaring, and we had those people standing in front of the fire drying out their clothing and warming up. So it did several things. Number one, it dried them out. It allowed us to dry out the canoe enough to put a patch on it. It was a traditional wood canvas boat, so we had to seal the hull again. But it dried the people out. It warmed them up. And most importantly, from my perspective as a guide, it sent the message to everybody in the party that we're on top of this, that, you know, we are taking care of it and we're managing the problem. So fire is our number two priority and the most important thing to practice over and over and over. Shelter building is priority number three. So shelter starts with our clothing and progresses out to include anything that creates a microclimate for our bodies. So we need to minimize the heat loss to the environment. And the way we do that is by being aware of the mechanisms of energy transfer, or how energy moves from one area of high concentration to low concentration. And there's four ways that this happens that can be illustrated with an introductory physics textbook. And they are conduction, convection, radiation, and evaporation. So when thinking about shelter, these are what I think about. Number one, conduction, is how do I get up off the ground and stop being in contact with anything super cold? Obviously, if I built a really nice lean-to, but I was laying on a big block of ice, it's not going to do me any good. So I need to get something so that anything that my body is in contact with is going to be a decent insulator, such as grass, leaves, wood, clothing, sleeping bag, foam pad, things of that nature. I want to be off the ground, off the snow, and off of anything that's going to keep me cold. Convection, I want to be out of the wind. Evaporation, I want to try to stay dry from any precipitation. And lastly, radiation, I want to have, I want to either take in heat, energy from a heat source, such as a fire or maybe the sun. And if I can't do that, I definitely want to insulate. So have a sleeping bag or a big pile of grass or a big pile of leaves to stop the heat energy that my body generates from being dissipated into the environment. So with regards to shelter, we always advocate to build a bed or a chair first. That way you have somewhere to sit or to lay down and take a rest. And while you're resting, you're not actively losing heat energy to the outside environment. Our fourth priority is water. Thirst is not a dependable indicator for internal water levels. So we need to drink enough water to pass a liter or a quart of urine daily, or to result in colorless or odorless urine. So that's more important. You know, passing that liter or quart is much more important than not feeling thirsty. But if you're tired, you're hungry, you're cold, drinking more water will probably improve your situation. So for me, I like to conspicuously and consciously hydrate at least once per day when I'm in the bush for an extended period of time. And that's usually in the morning. You know, I'll drink cup after cup of hot water until I have to eliminate some of that from my body. I don't like to do it in the evening because I hate getting out of a nice warm sleeping bag or out of a warm bed to have to go pee. So I'll try to do it first thing in the morning. And by starting the day by drinking a lot of water too, I'll eliminate any of those late afternoon dehydration headaches. With regards to water, if it isn't pure, say you have a questionable water source and you have no way to purify it, drink it anyway. There's a latency period for Giardia of about 12 to 14 days. So the idea is that you'll probably be home and back safe before those things take place and really get a hold on your system. So drink the water, and then when you get home, go to the doctor and get some antibiotics and mix them all together and take those to get rid of the Giardia. The important thing to remember is that you will probably die from dehydration-related stresses long before you'll die from Giardia as a result of having the runs or the trots. So drink the water and then worry about purifying it after. And the simplest way that I do purify water is to boil it. And there are lots of different opinions on this. I bring it to a rolling boil, and that's it. Obviously, I'm not recreating or spending time in places that are downstream from paint thinner factories or sewage treatment plants. The water is pretty clean where I'm at. You, depending on where you are and the pollutants in the water, you need to do some research and determine what you need to do to get those nasty things out of it. Signals are our fifth priority, and that's letting somebody know where you are so that they can come find you. So we have visual signals such as smoke from a signal fire or reflected light. We have audible signals, and a whistle is a great thing to carry, as three quick blasts are an internationally recognized distress signal. It could be blast from a whistle. It could also be three shots from a rifle, or three of any loud sound-making thing. So if you don't want to be found, then we need to minimize our signals. So minimize the amount of sound that we make. Minimize the amount of smoke from our campfire by choosing very dry, well-seasoned wood and splitting it up into small pieces. But going back to the whistle for a second, if you're ever out with kids, your kids or anyone else's, a whistle is a really cheap, really good insurance policy for kids not getting lost. So on my trips, I have a little code that I'll make sure that all the kids know that means if I blow my whistle one time, then they need to respond by blowing it once. And if I blow it two times, that means to everybody to bring it into camp. And obviously three times is that distress signal. And I make sure that I let them know in no uncertain terms that, don't blow this unless something really bad has happened. If you're on your way to the outhouse and you realize that you might not have enough toilet paper, don't blow the whistle three times. That should be reserved for something like someone drove an axe into their foot or, someone's drowning or something like that, because we don't want to be the boy who cried wolf and dull down that response time because we figure that people aren't taking it seriously. So probably the most important thing with the survival plan is to practice, with the idea being that it's too late to learn how to swim when the boat's sinking beneath you. Memorizing a survival plan will minimize indecisiveness and ensure rapid progress. Rapid progress will help you regain a sense of control, and that sense of control will boost confidence, both of you and the people with you. And acting quickly will take advantage of an adrenaline boost that you're sure to get when that fight or flight response kicks in. So the idea is to practice the plan and to know it cold. And as far as a progression, first, you need to know how to do all the things on the list. Second, you need to get good at them. Third, you need to get fast. And fourth, you need to be able to do it even in the dark or in the driving rain. So it's not enough to know how to light a fire. You need to keep working on the skill set until you're comfortable with it, even in severely adverse conditions. Part three is what you need to carry, or the gear and the tools that are going to make surviving in the forest or in the desert or wherever you're going to be a possibility. So with regards to the tools of survival, you need to be able to provide for yourself. So you need to choose a toolkit that's going to allow you to be able to do so. And what I'm talking about here are the tools that are going to be on your body. Not necessarily in a pack or in your vehicle. These are things that you need to have with you all the time. The most important tool for survival is going to be your clothing. That it's 3/4 of your total survival kit. And if you're dressed appropriately, but do everything else wrong, you should be able to stay alive for 4 days in cold weather. So there's 3 different ways of keeping warm. You can exercise, have a heat source, or insulate. And the most desirable for us is to insulate. If you think about spending the night out in cold weather, you don't want to be up running around all night, and it's less work to crawl into a warm sleeping bag than it is to feed a fire all night. Once again, in cold weather, we want to try to maintain one of 2 different body states. When we're active, we want to be comfortably cool, and when we're stationary, we want to be comfortably warm. So the problem comes is when people are stationary wearing a big heavy parka, and then they get up to be active and don't take it off soon enough, that very quickly your body recognizes that it's overheating and starts to sweat, and that sweat gets into the insulative layers and compromises them. So comfortably cool when active. And of all the environmental stresses, probably the biggest one to fear is wind when your clothes are wet. A couple other points about clothing: that natural fibers, such as wool and cotton, are going to be much better than synthetics around an open fire and sparks from an open fire. That the synthetics, such as fleece, are going to melt. So, you know, be aware that if you have like a fleece jacket on and someone was sleeping in front of the fire and managed to roll into the fire, that fleece jacket is plastic and it's going to melt to your skin and give you instant 3rd-degree burns. So if survival was difficult before that happened, now it's going to be just about impossible. excuse me. Footwear is the most technologically advanced because it's the only part of our body where we lose heat to conduction to the ground. So with that in mind, one way to make inadequate footwear better in the wintertime is to stand on something insulative. So if you're going to be standing around all day fishing on a frozen lake, or if you're going to go watch a hockey game in a really cold rink, bring a piece of foam pad with you to stand on, and it's going to make your feet that much warmer. And if you don't have a foam pad, you know, a couple of pieces of wood or some sticks or even some green boughs, all that stuff is going to get you up off of the cold ground and keep your feet that much warmer. After clothing, our next most important tool is fire. And you should carry several ways to ignite a fire. And the idea here is purposeful redundancy. Without tools like an axe and a saw to harvest wood, you're going to have to make do with the wood you can gather by hand. And that's usually the poor quality, you know, half broken down stuff that you find on the forest floor. And that stuff is not going to burn well. And the only way you're going to get it to burn well is to have a huge fire, because that extra heat is going to allow it to dry and fully combust. So be aware that if you're using a minimal toolkit, you're going to have a bigger fire. There's 5 stages to each fire. There's the ignition, the establishment, the application, the maintenance, and the extinguishment. So the ignition stage is, how do we get that first flame? And this is the sexy part of fire making. It's what all the fire making tools are based around. You know, the ferrocerium rod, crazy different types of matches, fire pistons, different types of lenses and things. So those are all great. They're fun toys and they're great to play with. The second stage, the establishment stage, is how do you turn that first initial flame into a roaring blaze regardless of the weather conditions? And that's the one that you should practice the most, because most people are going to have enough forethought to carry matches, a lighter, or some other surefire way of igniting a fire. So practice that establishment stage. The third stage, the application, things such as fuel arrangement and the fire lay come into play, with the idea that you're going to try to arrange things differently if you're trying to bake in a reflector oven, as opposed to if you're sleeping in front of it all night in bitter cold conditions. You're just going to set things up much, much differently. Maintenance comes back to that. How are we going to get enough wood to keep it going, and what type of wood? And this could be dragging wood back to your fire. It could also mean moving your camp every couple of days as you exhaust the fuel sources that are available locally. And lastly, extinguishment. And there's 2 ways to extinguish a fire. You either need a lot of time or a lot of water, or a combination of the two. So that nagging feeling that people get at the end of a stay at a certain campsite when they've moved on down the trail and they say, yeah, I'm pretty sure that fire was out. We don't want that feeling. That's not good enough. You need to know that it's out and have no questions in your mind. So one of the key points here is the morning before breaking camp, don't have a big fire. Maybe cook your breakfast just on a few little twigs so that when they're completely out and you don't have a big, horrible log smoldering in the fire that you need to dump 30 gallons of water on. After a fire, a knife is the most important tool. With a knife, you can make fine wood shavings, and with fine wood shavings, you can light a fire in wet or adverse weather. A fire can save your life. So that's where my definition of a survival knife is one that you can make fine wood shavings to light a fire with. Any knife can cut string, gut a trout, or spread peanut butter, but you need one that's going to make fine wood shavings. And a few characteristics of a good knife are that it should be sturdy and have a fixed blade, and the blade should be about the length of the width of your hand. So about 5 inches or so is a pretty good general purpose knife. You know, it could be bigger or smaller depending on your personal preferences. But if you don't have one, that's a good place to start. I tend to go with carbon steel knives because I can use them for percussion-based fire lighting. And obviously the angle of the bevel that the knife is ground on should be designed for working wood. It's a woodworking tool after all, because if we go back to its most basic role of making fine wood shavings, you know, there's some knives out there with very steep bevels that just won't do that well. Lastly, it should have a deep sheath to avoid loss, and the steel should be such that you can keep it at just about razor sharp in the field without too much difficulty. A sharp knife is a safe knife. Anybody who tells you that it's safer because the knife is dull is completely full of it. Because you need to push that much harder with a dull knife, you lose control that you have when the knife is sharp. After a knife, we should have a first aid and signaling kit in our pocket. And this should be adequate enough to deal with a knife cut or an axe cut or whatever tool you're carrying. And the entire kit should be in a small enough little pouch that it'll fit in a shirt pocket. In a group setting, I always make sure that the kit is labeled for the reason that it could be me that fell and got a bump on the head or was knocked out and had a bad cut, and I want people to be able to find that. So in my kit, I always carry Steri-Strips, assorted bandages, and definitely duct tape that you can tape a wound closed with. A signal mirror is a great little thing that doesn't take up a lot of space, and you can also use it to remove little particles from your eye in addition to signaling. And a little magnifying Fresnel lens can help you see little splinters, and it can also be a fire lighter for you by refracting the sunlight. So it should definitely fit in your shirt pocket. When I'm guiding, I have a big comprehensive first aid kit that rides in one of the packs, but I also always carry the little kit in my pocket so that if I'm during the day someone gets a cut or something, then I don't have to tear everything apart to get a bandage or something like that. So I carry two. As far as signaling devices, a whistle is a great thing to have, and you can, without too much difficulty, learn how to make one out of an old beer can, aluminum. So I've been all over North America, and I have not been anywhere where I couldn't locate a beer can in the bushes. And sometimes it's amazing that someone would carry, you know, a beer with them on some remote mountain trail up to the summit of some mountain and then drink a beer and then just chuck the can in the bushes. But it happens. So learning how to make a whistle out of a beer can is a very good thing to have. After a first aid and signaling kit, you need to carry some navigation with you. And this could be a map and compass. If you carry a map and compass, make sure you know how to use a map and compass. And if you learn the art of barehanded navigation, you can get by without carrying a map and compass. So the minimum skill set with regards to navigation that you should have is, first, you should be able to find your cardinal points. And, you know, north, south, east, or west, using a compass, using the sun, using the stars. And second, you need to be able to travel in a straight line. So most people tend to veer to the right as they travel. And we travel, as humans, tend to travel in a giant circle. the classic study was to blindfold people and put them on the 50-yard line of a football field and tell them to walk into the end zone, and most people would go out of bounds between the 9 and the 2-yard line on the right side. You know, a few would go to the left, and occasionally somebody gets into the end zone, but the idea is not to try to figure out why that happens. The idea is to acknowledge that it does happen and take steps to counteract it. And this is by learning how to travel in a straight line. And in forested country, we remember our high school geometry class that two points define a line. So I line up two objects and then pick a third object in the distance that's in line with them, travel to the third one, and then pick another object and keep sighting back. So I keep all those things in a line, and that's going to allow me to travel in a straight line. In open country, especially snow-covered lake, or if you're in sand, you can drag something behind you. If you have a piece of rope, you know, drag a stick or something behind you. And then as you travel, you can look back and look at the track that you've made and make adjustments to see if you're veering one way or the other. So different approaches, whether you're in open or forested country. Lastly, you should have some string or cordage in your pockets. That there's a quote in the book, The Survival Arts of the Primitive Paiutes by Margaret Wheat, that goes, "The world of primitive man was tied together with bits of string." So string is not difficult to make in the wild, but it does take time. And that time is going to be crucial to you because you're probably going to need to be worrying about getting more firewood or getting more water or things. You don't want to be wasting that time. Once you've got a camp set up and you know that you're going to be okay, then you can take time and make natural string. But at least in the beginning, have some with you. It doesn't weigh much. It's cheap. It helps with shelter construction and about 1,000 other tasks. And it's good to learn how to tie knots that you can untie so that you don't have to cut your string. Some other tools for survival that you may not carry on your person all the time are a sleeping bag and pad. If you have a sleeping bag and can keep it dry and a pad to keep you off the ground, then you know you're way, way ahead of the game. Shelter components, and we tend to think of things that are difficult to find in the natural world, such as maybe a tarp or a piece of plastic, something that's windproof and waterproof that can be carried with you, is a super valuable tool. A metal pot that you can boil water in to purify it is incredibly valuable. An axe is, for my money, the most useful tool, and I carry one with me wherever I go, because it can do so many different things, from build a regular log cabin to put up a sizable pile of firewood. That an axe can do just about everything a knife can do, but a knife can't do everything an axe can do. Lastly, you know, snare wire is a good thing to have. Some fish hooks if you know how to catch fish. And in the wintertime, I always carry an ice chisel if I'm in and around lakes or rivers to test the ice and to chip holes in order to get drinking water. So we've talked about what is important to carry as far as tools go, but we haven't really touched on survival kits. Survival kits are something you pack ahead of time based on what you think you're going to need in order to make it through an extended stay, whether in the bush or it could be in the city when you don't have any infrastructure, such as running water or whatnot. And it's important to keep in mind that the materials in your survival kit should directly help you in your quest to sleep, hydrate, and maintain body temperature. And if they don't, they shouldn't be in your kit. It's also important to remember that a kit should reflect the training, experience, and fitness level of its owner, as well as be specific to the activity or application and location. So, for example, maybe I wouldn't pack a little square box that I could make snow blocks with in order to make some sort of a snow shelter if I was going to be in the deserts of the Southwest. It's important to remember that one size here does not fit all. As far as basic survival goes, food is pretty common in survival kits, but it adds a lot of weight, and from a physiological perspective, it really isn't necessary. So you need to figure out where you're going to be, what your skill level is, and what you're trying to accomplish, and then pack your kit. You know, don't go buy a commercial one because the salesman said that this is all you'll ever need, because usually it's just simply not the case. Before we wrap things up, I want to talk about preparing and being ready to deal with an incident and what you can do to get yourself ready and your family ready. So number one is going to be practice skills. So these are things that you can do at home on a regular basis, and you should be working with them, such as building fires at home and maybe cooking over the fire. Or if you can't do it at home, maybe at a nearby park if home isn't an option. But, you know, being able to cook food that you and your family are going to eat. It's a bad thing to do to wait until you're stuck out somewhere and then realize that all you can do is burn meat or you know, not boil things well enough so that they're cooked. So fire and food go right together here. Number two is to sleep outside a few times each season. And just to increase your familiarity with doing it, if nothing else, but also just to stay sort of in tune with that and realize that, you know, you might be doing this more regularly if something bad were to happen. So how do you maintain a comfort level with doing that? Number three is to increase your level of physical fitness. Outdoor living and travel is very physically arduous, and the better shape that you're in, the easier it's going to be. So, for example, something that if someone's in horrible physical condition, then, you know, building a shelter and sleeping in it for the weekend and gathering enough wood for a fire is going to be a miserable experience because they're going to be working really hard. Their body's going to be sweating, you know, aches and pains, muscles you haven't used much. For someone who has a higher level of fitness, it's not going to be as big of a deal. So increase your fitness level, both strength and aerobic. Number four is to prepare and eat simple foods until it's second nature. You know, a lot of people these days are hooked on convenience foods. And, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, but if you're really interested in being prepared to for an extended stay in the forest or without infrastructure, you know, those foods simply aren't going to be there. So you need to, you know, work at being able to cook in a good way and enjoy eating things like beans, things like whole grains that store very well. You know, get used to drinking just water without all sorts of sodas and carbonation and things with it. So a simple diet, you know, revel in it. Number five is to have a plan of where you would go in an emergency. So just like having a survival plan, if things go awry when you're in the forest, you know, having a plan of what to do if something were to transpire that you'd have to leave your home is a really good thing to have. And once again, you're going to be faced with that reptile brain. So if you haven't planned ahead in advance, you know, the odds of you being able to do so rationally in that moment of crisis are very low. Number six is to run a simulation. And this is saying, you know, being prepared by saying that, okay, we're going to simulate that something bad has happened and we're leaving home with the things we can carry and then going and doing it. That you learn so much more from actually getting out and doing something than you ever would from studying or taking information passively. At our school, we run once a year a walkabout with no food so that we're foraging as we go. And, you know, that experience of just having to forage as you go and, you know, knowing what your body's going through and learning those lessons that really can't be learned any other way, it's invaluable, and it would be invaluable for you as well. So say if your plan is to head to the national forest that's 20 miles away and maybe you're going to walk it, then maybe once a year you should walk that. And then you'll get to know places along the way, like, oh, here's a good water source. Here's a good resource for cattails. Here's a good, you know, an old lumber yard where there's some old tarps that would cover lumber in the back that I could steal or borrow and use for shelters and things. So getting out and actually doing it is a huge, huge value. And lastly, networking with others. You know, being able to share and trade skill sets. There's a reason why humans have always lived in villages and things, and there's a reason why in the past, if someone in a native tribe did something that was socially unacceptable, they would be banished to live on their own, because this was basically a suicide sentence, in that it's very difficult for one person to be able to do everything that a family would need in order to make life in the forest. So networking with others and sharing skill sets, you know, maybe you're really good at lighting fires and your next door neighbor who has a similar mindset is really good at growing vegetables. So you put instead of everybody trying to learn everything, you put those two skill sets together and you've got a much more complete skill set. So networking with others is a huge component. Well, that concludes this talk on survival. I'm Tim Smith from the Jack Mountain Bushcraft School. You can check us out on the web at jackmtn.com or just do a Google search for Bushcraft School. Thank you.